It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about a public health problem facing senior citizens, injuries from falling, and we'll talk about how to prevent them.
First, President Obama spoke at the United Nations General Assembly this morning and fired back at Russian President Vladimir Putin's assertion that the United States is not exceptional.
The president said he believes the U.S. is exceptional, and he defended the role America has played in international affairs.
Well, is the U.S. truly exceptional? Should we have a strong role in the conflicts of other countries? Our guest says no. Joining us now is Christopher Preble, Vice President of Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Christopher, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as we said, President Obama spoke at the UN today, insisted on this idea of American exceptionalism, the idea that the U.S. has a greater responsibility on the world stage than other countries. Now, it's not a new concept of America. Do you think it's still the right position for America today?
Well, I think it really depends on what we mean by exceptional. I certainly think this country is exceptional. I think most Americans feel that way, and it's become sort of a catchphrase to criticize either the president or his critics at different times. But it's really what sort of exceptionalism. You know, the founders of this country envisioned it as a city on a hill, a model to be emulated, one that that would show other countries how to build a good society, build a thriving economy, protect the rights and privileges of its citizens, and expect that that model would inspire others to follow our lead. Somewhere along the line in American history, most people dated to the turn of the 20th century, we became more of a crusader state, that is, someone, a country that would go around the world and try to promote this idea, not as a model to be emulated, but actually actively trying to promote it. And I think we see, we see, especially after the Iraq and Afghanistan, quite a bit of unhappiness, frankly, and dissatisfaction among the American people with trying to do this by force. We've learned that it doesn't work very well. We've learned that it isn't always appreciated. And ultimately, I think we've learned that it isn't really necessary for our security at the end of the day.
Well, seen from one example, it's exceptionalism, as you just defined it originally, being sort of a model, mm-hmm. a beacon on the hill, as you said. But seen in other lights, the U.S. can be seen as a watchdog or as a lone wolf. And we do have other bodies of governance now on the world stage. The U.N., for instance, is one of these. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the question is, how does the U.S., see itself in light of changes in the world and how governance is run these days?
Well, the UN is still a collection of sovereign states. So at the end of the day, the members, each individual member in the UN is prepared or is considers how they will respond based on their own interests, based on the support back at home, based on their own laws. The United States, in that respect, is no different. We have a system of laws. We have certain rules governing when, for example, the United States deploys forces abroad. And I think we saw, especially in the case of Syria, that in a representative democracy, the people have a voice. The people's representatives last month made quite clear they were not willing to support the use of the force in Syria as the president proposed. And so we're left with something else, that is other countries being encouraged to do more and step up, with the United States still playing an important role, but not expected to play the only role. And I think that was one of the key lessons to take away from what happened with respect to the Syria case.
Does that mean that Americans, you think, are a little fatigued with the notion of exceptionalism, especially if it's America in there all by itself?
Yes, in the sense that they don't want America to be in there all by ourselves. Certainly, if our core interests are at stake, if our security is threatened, then we are prepared to act unilaterally even. It would be our preference, however, to have allies who are cooperating with us, providing some of the forces or at least supporting us diplomatically and financially along the way. That's, that kind of the next best scenario. But in the case of Syria, you didn't even have that, or it's a very belated and very begrudging. Some of the states in the region were willing to support us, but not in a very meaningful way. And I think that's why the American people were, on top of everything else, on top of their general fatigue, were particularly disinterested in intervening there.
Well, Russia provided us with a kind of plan B, President Obama, I should say, with a plan B in terms of intervening in Syria. But that chapter of the book is not closed by any means. And at the UN, President Obama still said, you know, he hoped that if things didn't go as agreed upon, if Syria didn't surrender the chemical weapons, then we would need to intervene. And I'm wondering what you think about how receptive the UN and other countries will be if that's the case.
Well, it's been a very uneven track record, let's be honest. You know, there have been some uses of force that have been sanctioned by the UN Security Council, most recently against Libya. But I think even the experience in Libya is a bit of a cautionary tale for some member states. You know, that operation was supposed to be designed merely to protect the population in the city of Benghazi, but then it was used as a justification for ultimately overthrowing Muammar Gaddafi, and, you know, he ultimately was killed in the process. And since then, Libya is not exactly a model of stability and security in the region. So I think that given that experience, there's going to be considerable resistance at the UN to sanctioning the use of force as the ultimate punishment. Not that it would be impossible, but that it will just be a harder sell for those who want that kind of a formal sanction by the UN.
Well, in terms of Iran as well, that's another thing that President Obama indicated that the U.S. is watching closely and, you know, is hopeful about the outcome there. But what do you think will happen in terms of the United States having a responsibility to intervene again should Iran proceed with development of nuclear weapons?
Well, I think that to the extent that the multilateral sanctions, and it really is a broad-based effort, have clearly had an impact on the Iranian economy. They've made it difficult for Iran to use the international banking system. It's clearly had an effect on the people of Iran. It's not surprising that the government there is trying to come up with ways to ease those sanctions. And one way might be to enter into negotiations in exchange for relaxing the sanctions. The problem is that, as I see it, is that here in the United States, here in Washington, there's much less willingness. There's a lot of willingness to talk about increasing sanctions or increasing penalty. There's much less willingness to talk about what could the Iranians do in a concrete way that would result in the United States lessening those sanctions or easing those sanctions. In other words, I haven't heard many people here in Washington talk about what would be accepting yes for an answer. We hear a lot about what the Iranians are not supposed to be doing, but not a lot about what the United States is willing to forego in exchange for the Iranians meeting some of their commitments.
Now, in that opinion piece that ran last week by Vladimir Putin that, you know, provided the backdrop for the United States to sort of backpedal on the red line against Syria. Mm-hmm. At the end of that piece, Putin had a little paragraph about, you know, the time of American exceptionalism is over and we're all sort of this, I can't remember the exact wording, but it was sort of we're all citizens of the world.
Right.
One country is not exceptional and another unexceptional, and that this notion, you know, is sort of dated. What did you make of that? And how do you think that was received internationally?
Well, I can't speak to internationally, but it really is pretty absurd. You know, Vladimir Putin is the president of a country that its entire economy is about the size of the Iberian Peninsula, and Russia is literally dying. They have a demographic problem because their life expectancy is shrinking and their population is shrinking. So the notion of Vladimir Putin speaking as though he were the leader of a world power is really quite absurd. It would be a little different if the leader of China, for example, or leader of some of the other truly growing and dynamic economies in the world made that charge. But even they would have a very kind of thin argument to make. After all, the United States is still overwhelmingly dominant in terms of its military power, its economic power. Even though we account for just about 5% of the world's population, we still account for about 25% of its wealth and about 45% of its military spending. So, you know, again, we can define exceptionalism lots of different ways. I think we shouldn't narrowly define it as our ability to fight and win wars. I think it's the other things that make us truly exceptional and worth celebrating. I don't take my many lessons from Vladimir Putin, and frankly, I don't think many Americans do. But equally important, I don't think many people elsewhere in the world follow Vladimir Putin's guidance or listen to what Russia has to say these days.
But given the case you just laid out, the reasons that America can be seen as exceptional, I mean, to kind of borrow from the Spider-Man adage, with great power comes great responsibility. I mean, is that true of the United States right now?
It has been, and I think it's something I've written about quite a bit in my life. I think we built up this military power, and it really goes back to the end of World War II and the Cold War. We built up this military power. We were defending countries that were badly broken by war and warfare, shattered physically, but also emotionally, psychologically. These countries have since recovered, recovered spectacularly. They are wealthy. They are safe. And the time has come for other countries to step forward and to do a bit more, certainly in their own defense, but also to defend common interests. The good news is we have many other allies around the world that do share our interests. What we don't have, unfortunately, is allies with the capabilities and the willingness to use them. And I think that's where we really need to be moving as a country, precisely because of what I just said. While it's true that we account for about 25% of the world's wealth, that percentage is declining, and we're not going to be able to sustain, at least not indefinitely, being the world's policeman without anyone contributing anything, at least to their own security and ideally to global challenges.
All right, we'll leave it there. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Chris Preble, Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute.
Coming up, we'll check the news. Then we're talking about a public health issue, preventing injuries from falling, especially for senior citizens. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
For the elderly, falling down isn't as easy as getting right back up. In fact, a fall can lead to the end of a person's independence.
Our next guest says adult falls are a public health issue. She wants to raise awareness and share some prevention tips. Cheryl Whitkey is with us. She's Executive Director of Safe Communities. That's a Dane County nonprofit dedicated to public health. Cheryl, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So this is one of those issues that doesn't really capture the imagination. It sounds mundane, but it's a really big deal. Can you talk about how big a problem adult falling is?
It is a really big deal. In Wisconsin, it's our number one cause of injury-related hospitalizations and deaths for older adults. And the thing about that that's tragic is that it's largely preventable. There's an awful lot that we can do to prevent older adults from injuring themselves in falls and losing their independence.
It sounds to younger people, it may not sound like that big a deal. You fall down, you get up. But as we get older, I have this to look forward to. Those falls could be more damaging. Talk about some of the, I guess, complications of falls.
Right. Well, if a person fractures their hip, for example, lots of times then they're laid up, and then that puts them at much higher risk for pneumonia and other sorts of related health issues. And it isn't easier. It isn't easy to recover from that as an older person. All of us fall, we trip over rugs, but, when you look at the environment and you look at sort of intrinsic factors that relate to falls, like medications, where maybe we're not metabolizing them in the same way that we did in the past, balance issues, all of those things make older adults more at risk for more serious falls.
Before we get into prevention, I want to talk about some of the costs here. You mentioned the loss of independence, but talk about the money cost. How big a hit is this?
Well, it's huge. One hospitalization related to a fall is $33,000, and that's just an average cost, and that doesn't include all the rehabilitation that goes along with it or the nursing home care that, that might follow that. So it's huge. And again, can be spent in better ways, can be prevented.
Well, let's talk about some prevention. You've got a seminar coming up just in a day or two, I think, and we'll let you plug that in a minute. But what kind of things can, first, what can you teach older people to do to avoid falls?
Well, there's four really key factors that relate to falls risk. One is balance. And, it's great to be doing cardiovascular activity, and we need to do that our whole lives. The other thing we want to add as we get older is balance activities. So just cardiovascular activity like walking doesn't necessarily reduce your falls risk. So things like Tai Chi, other balance challenging exercises, even if you're standing at the kitchen counter and you do some leg raises and test your balance, that can be a huge issue. So there's the physical component to that. The other thing is vision screening. They used to say that if you wanted to wait till your cataracts were ripe before they removed them. Now the thinking is pretty much that you want to have your cataracts taken care of right away and have your vision checked regularly. Maybe ask your physician about bifocals or not, because you'll notice as you're looking through bifocals that that's quite distorting if you're trying to climb stairs, those sorts of things. So vision screening is really important. The other huge issue is medication and the interactions of medications, not just prescription medicines, but also over-the-counter things like Tylenol PM and those kinds of things. So making sure that the medications that you're taking aren't interacting in such a way that could make you dizzy. And then finally, the home environment. So, and there's lots of really great programs out there that can help you make your home safe.
One thing I think about is we're in Wisconsin. The ice is treacherous at any age. Is that part of the training there? How, when to not walk on the ice, or safer ways to get around in the winter?
Yeah, as long as people don't limit their activity. I think the one thing that we want to be sure not to do is be so afraid of falling that we don't move, because then that definitely increases your falls risk. The other thing that's interesting is in Wisconsin, we actually have the second highest death rate from falls in the nation. Number one is New Mexico. Minnesota and Michigan, the states around us that have a similar climate, don't have the same kind of falls risks.
What are they doing?
Well, it could be that we're really good at keeping track of this in Wisconsin, and I think that's true. We have really good data surveillance kind of methods. Maybe it's greater gravitational pull. Maybe it's more brandy consumption in Wisconsin. Those are all things that we've jokingly speculated at on our task force. But you know, so we don't seem to think that it's the weather. And actually the falls, if you look at it seasonally, there are more falls actually in April, when people may be getting out for the first time after staying in and may be weakened.
What age should people start thinking about this, either for themselves or for their parents?
Well, really, you want to be thinking about it from young on. You know, I mean, I'm in my early 50s, and I've already noticed a difference in balance that I need to be working on. I think if everybody started younger, we would have fewer issues as people get older. So, but then also we see, you know, particularly in the later 70s, early 80s, that's when a lot more falls happen. And I think a lot of that is because people tend to limit their activity or maybe sort of close in a little bit more. There's lots of great programs out there that can get you out there and get you moving, and that's really helpful.
This sounds cheap compared to the cost you mentioned earlier of hospitalization.
Absolutely. It is. And, you know, and just the mental anguish that goes along with the loss of independence, you can't really quantify that, or the pain with the numbers. And I want to mention that there's a lot of great networks out there that are supporting the kind of programming that older adults can use. We're one coalition here in Dane County. There's great injury prevention, falls prevention coalitions in Kenosha, Green Bay, La Crosse, lots of other communities. If people want to go to the websites of their aging and disabilities resource centers in their communities, they can find out information about programs like the Stepping On program, which is an evidence-based program that's been shown to reduce falls among older adults by 50%. And Tai Chi classes, all those sorts of things are available, and people can plug into them.
When I was poking around online, it seems like this is a big movement. There are seminars, there are events going on in states all over the country. Are we starting to take this seriously as a public health issue?
We are, and there's also really great resources now on the Centers for Disease Control website for clinicians. And I encourage clinicians to look at this. I mean, clearly they're really busy, but there's great tools on this website that can help people identify falls risks and then make proper referrals to physical therapy, those kinds of things.
Kim on Facebook writes, can you address the stubbornness and denial sometimes in older people? My father fell, broke his hip because he refused to use a cane, said he didn't need it. What advice do you have in that situation?
That is huge. That is a big issue that we hear all the time. We do tend to focus on independence in the messaging as opposed to prevent falls and, you know, don't hurt yourself. So I think, I mean, you know your dad better than anybody, and I've got I'm sort of in the same boat with my family. But I think that message of independence, if you want to be on your own, it's important to take these kinds of steps to do this. And, you know, we're here to help you. And here's some programs. Also, I think especially older adults, they need this message from their clinicians. So having a conversation with your father's doctor maybe about resources and approaches would be a good idea.
Can we wrap up by hearing about your events? You've got something coming up in a couple days on that.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, there's a lot of these kinds of things going on around the country, but around Wisconsin, because it is National Falls Prevention Month, September is. So tomorrow we have an event at Covenant Presbyterian Church in Madison called Only Leaves Should Fall, in honor of fall and not falling. And basically, there'll be about 40 different organizations there screening people for falls risk, including a bunch of students from the UW different health programs like PT and OT. And so people will leave with, really with a prescription of how to prevent falls for them, for themselves.
All right. Cheryl, thank you so much for coming up and talking about this today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Cheryl Whitke. She's Executive Director of Safe Communities. That's a Dane County nonprofit dedicated to public health.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk with the son of late journalist Alexander Coburn about Coburn's last book on American politics, finished just before his death last year.
Plus, film director M. Night Shyamalan joins us to talk about his blueprint for what he says could close the achievement gap in American schools.
And we'll have with us live and in studio the actor John O'Hurley, who's in Wisconsin this week. He's going to be starring as Billy Flynn in the touring Broadway show Chicago.
A lot going on tomorrow. Hope you'll join us here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, our guest says 10 virtues of outstanding leaders.
And PBS's Ray Suarez tells us about the rich and influential history of Latinos in America. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after 4, our guest will share some memories about lava lamps on their 50th anniversary.
First, what does it take to be a good leader? Is it an inborn talent, a skill we can acquire, or is it something deeper?
Al Genie has been thinking about those questions. He's professor of business ethics and chair of the management department at Loyola University Chicago. He's co-author of 10 Virtues of Outstanding Leaders, Leadership, and Character. Al, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
But when I think of leadership, if I think of it at all, I think of it as like a set of skills or maybe a personality style. You say it's a matter of character and virtue. Why?
Well, it's actually fundamentally about that, and I want to come back to that. When you ask anybody what's a leader or who are your favorite leaders, they'll come up with kind of an obvious group of people or even a divergent group of people, but they'll all be somewhat different in demeanor and talent and temperament. And I think there's no one specific definition of leadership. I don't think there's one specific leader or one specific leader model that, you know, takes care of every possibility. But rather, I think, and there won't no series of attributes that are absolutely there, but rather I think that at the bottom, at the foundation of leadership, there's something you have to call character and something we want to call stewardship. That is, why are you a leader? What do you believe in and why are you a leader? And secondly, why are you leading the way you are leading? That is, what is your real job? And I think how people answer that is the foundation for leadership. And then everything else depends not on a definition, but rather a variable formula.
So by the time we're grown-ups and we're getting into leadership positions, is it possible to change our character and develop the virtues we're going to talk about, or are we locked in? It's too late.
Well, you know, character from the Greek is, you know, characteros, but it's about the etchings that are marked on us and like in stone. But now, modern psychology and I think modern philosophy suggests that there's also the learned character, the acquired character. But character, I mean what you value, what you believe in, what you're willing to act on, what empowers you, what brings you into the world. Eleanor Roosevelt said it best, you want to know a person's character, check their checkbook. How do they spend their money? Mm. What do they do? And I think character, like so much that we do in life, we expand, we develop. But after a certain point, I think there becomes this fixed nexus, this fixed, you know, center post that we call character. And that's how we judge people. That's how we decide if someone is a friend. That's how we decide if this person is a lover. That's how we decide if we really care about our family. What do they believe in and how do they act it out?
When people are taught to be managers or leaders, whether at an MBA school mm-hmm. or in a leadership seminar, is what you're talking about what they're getting, or is it a set of tactics?
Well, you know, if you go around the country and look at the leadership courses in MBA programs, you'll find every difference possible. And you get a lot of OD stuff, organizational development. What do you do when 3 employees come in and one is claiming unfair practice, so on and so forth? And I call that kind of management manipulation. How do you handle that best in that circumstance? If you take my advanced course in leadership, it starts with the first book written on leadership, which is Plato's Republic, you know, and the pursuit of justice, and how do you organize a state. So I think there are theoretical models by handling it, and there are also mechanical, more behavior modification models. But both are necessary. Nobody wants, I'm reading Wilson's book right now. Wilson was a student of leadership. I'm reading Wilson's biography, excuse me. But Wilson also believed that leadership can't simply be a series of, ideological statements. It has to be lived out amongst others for it to be real.
The core of your book is looking at virtues and how to develop them and role models to look to. Why do you think it was important to look for historical role models historical and present day, I should say?
Yeah. Aristotle said we really don't learn virtue by reading a treatise on ethics. We learn virtue by the witness of others. We learn virtue by how other people behave. Garrison Keillor on these airwaves said years ago that if you want your children not to smoke, not to drink, and not to eat meat, you have two alternatives. You don't smoke, eat meat and you don't drink, or you do smoke, you do eat meat. You know, one way or another, they'll react to it, and I think that's true. So I think we've always held up these wonderful leaders. And so this book, in some sense, is about characters with character. But having said that, perhaps the best contribution that this book makes of, the 20,000-plus books out there on leadership, is we talk about the importance of studying bad leaders as well. Because not to study bad leaders is to be vulnerable to their tactics and their strategy. Not to study bad leaders is like going to medical school that only teaches health but never touches on disease.
I want to get into the good leaders in a minute and the virtues. Who's a bad leader? Who's a cautionary example? Give us one or two.
Well, in the modern world right now, I mean, the players at Enron are a classic example. And I thought Enron would be the benchmark forever. Jeff Skillings and the organizer of the place as well. And I'm blanking on his name right now. Please forgive me. That whole cadre of people who, if you see the film, Smartest Guys in the Room, you see these men talking about the manipulation of others for self-aggrandizement and self-wealth. They, to me, were the worst kinds of misleaders. And then suddenly Bernie Madoff shows up, this nice little guy who in one part of his life runs a reputable firm and another part of his life manages about 1,500 people and misplaces about $62 billion along the way. I'm afraid that the list would go on much longer than the list of good leaders if we had time.
Well, the examples you just gave point me toward the last of the 10 virtues, at least in the order you present them in the book, deep selflessness. That sounds like it was lacking among Ken Lay and the others at Enron. Talk about selflessness as an important virtue.
I think that that's what we really mean by character, that outstanding leaders are not selfish. That is, they are not concerned about self, but they are not selfish. That their primary role and how they see themselves is in service to others. That once you become a leader, your life has now changed. You are not, as St. Augustine said, the first and the last rule of leadership is the well-being of those that they lead. And I think that selflessness does not mean that you don't care about yourself. Any parent knows you have to take care of yourself in order to take care of your children. And children are, in some sense, those people we lead. And let's forget all the particular domestic problems that come up along the way about cars, milk, and what you're eating right now. But rather, you give up a part of your life in having children, or you should, I think. And I think that anyone who runs for office is saying, I'm willing to do this for the greater good. This is a republic in the classic sense, that we elect people to be our servants. I loved what Harry Truman said when he gave up the presidency. I return to what Jefferson announced as a higher calling, a higher title, Mr. Citizen.
But that's a paradox, it seems like, because if somebody wanted to come up with a personality profile of someone who sought power and a leadership role, it seems like self-aggrandizement and self-advancement would be one of their core values.
But that's a norm, that doesn't make it right. In point of fact, that's what we want to suggest. There's nothing wrong with ambition. John Adams said, I am ambitious to be successful in freedom so that my children need not worry about freedom as a gift of life, okay? Ambition is a good thing. I want to be, in fact, that wonderful film Patton. Remember, they're sitting, they're being pinned down. It's George Patton and Bradley. and they're sitting down there, and Bradley says to Patton, Georgie, you do this because you love it. I do it because I'm trained to do it, and somebody's got to. That's who I want to hire, not George Patton for all of his bravado and success and technique and competence. I want Omar Bradley, who did it because it was a task to be done. And I think that we have simply been, if I'm talking too much, make me stop, we've simply been, you know, to accept ambition as narcissism. No, I want to be a good teacher because my students deserve it. I want to be a good surgeon because my patients deserve it. That's ambitious ambition that I think is righteous.
And your illustrative example for deep selflessness in your book is Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah, and in retrospect, we should have made it a double characteristic at the end, and that should have been Martin Luther King Jr. and Nelson Mandela in a very real sense. Martin Luther King Jr. was not a man without his own peculiar personal failures. He was a man who liked a Baptist minister who liked to drink and liked to smoke and liked clothes, and by his own admission and by his wife's admission, was not totally faithful during the course of his marriage. But putting that aside, at the age of 27 years old, you know, he became the leader of a movement that he had no desire to be in. But once he was there, he realized that it was his responsibility, and he dedicated his life to it. Now, I think we're both old enough to remember that Martin Luther King was not the only leader of the black movement, the civil rights movement at the time, that he was not universally always loved on every issue, but he drove civil rights in a way that it would never be driven before, and in a way that it would not be stopped. Having said that, when he was shot on that balcony in Atlanta, it halted the movement, but it did not destroy it. And I think Nelson Mandela, who's still with us at 95 years of age, is my hero of heroes. He is Africa's Lincoln, although both men are clouded by mystery and mystique and, you know, a kind of iconic folklore. He referred to 27 years in prison as the University of Life. He went in a terrorist and a rebel. He came out a Gandhian pacifist and a Democrat. There's something magnificent about that transition. And both men that I should be lauded.
We're talking to Al Genie about the value of character, of ethics, and values in leadership. And we'll touch on some more of the values he's looking for in a great leader. He's co-author of The 10 Virtues of Outstanding Leaders.
And you can join in now. What do you think makes someone a great leader? Is it the moral characteristics we're talking about or something else? Is there someone you would point to as a great leader? Maybe someone you know personally, or maybe someone more well-known, past or present. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on our Facebook page. Look for it at Central Time on WPR.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. We're talking about leadership now with Al Genie, and we want to hear from you. Who would you point to as a great leader in politics, in business, in the spiritual realm? Maybe someone you've worked with. What makes a great leader, and what qualities go into that leadership? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email talk@wpr.org.
Al, we'll get to the phones in a couple minutes, but I wanted to get into some more of the virtues you talk about. Let's go with the first one, deep honesty. How does that work? Why is that an important virtue?
Can I back up and say the 10 we've listed are 10 that we think are kind of critical, but there are others as well. When you understand virtue to be a habit, a chosen behavior that that advances the good life, that lets us live better with others, we think that these 10 are kind of sine qua non, you know, basic. But of course there would be others, but one has to limit one's realm. Well, deep honesty, you know, that's part of almost the selflessness. I think that we have to avoid deception. We have to avoid misinterpretation. What a concept, you know, honesty and advertisement. I think deep honesty is about trust, transparency, and being willing not to deceive in an intentional manner. That doesn't mean you answer every question, but it does mean sometimes you say, as a leader, no comment, I'm not sure, I'll get back to you. That's not a weakness. Rather, that's a clarification and an invitation to ask me again when I know.
And the example you give there, James Burke.
Yeah, the famous Tylenol, and part of that Tylenol happened right here in Chicago. Tylenol happened not far from where I'm speaking right now, where when 7 people went down with what was considered now random urban terrorism, cyanide put into Tylenol, And Burke came in there and said, we're through. You know, everyone said, you're through. This is done. Close this downtown. And it was over Johnson & Johnson. It's big enough. And he said, no, we got to find out what's going on here. We have an obligation to our stakeholders, to the people we work with, the people we work for, and the people we come to work to serve. We got to find out what happened here. It's not enough to just avoid liability or pay this off. We want to understand what went wrong. And so even though he could have taken the easy way, he did the right thing for the right reason on purpose. He examined everything at the Tylenol end. He did all reparations possible for the victims at the time. And ironically, at the end, 10 years later, they received about a $50 million settlement because there should have been some preparation for it, but it was a technicality. But I think James Burke wound up being the good guy here because he was trying to be helpful. He wasn't simply trying to CYA, a term from Vietnam, which I'm sure the audience is aware of. He was trying rather to be honest, be open, and tell the truth.
Well, and that would be the gut instinct a lot of the time, cover your rear end and lawyer up.
Right, right. You know, Mark Twain once said, when in a difficult situation, tell the truth. It'll befuddle your enemies and surprise your friends. But I think there's something absolutely correct about that. And, you know, deep honesty is really about truth. And when I tell my students, when I ask my business students, what's the word fiduciary mean? Well, they say, money responsibility, you know, money obligations. I said, no, not at all. It isn't financial. It starts with an F. It's from fidere, the Latin for truthfulness. That's why dogs used to be called Fido. To be truthful, to be dependable. That's really the bond between business, the bond between lovers, the bond between friends, that you can trust me, that I will be faithful to our relationship. Infidelity in marriage is not about having sex with another, but rather by being unfaithful, emotionally unfaithful, in regard to truth with another, which would include sex, but not the only issue.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Scott with us in Iron River. Hi there, Scott.
Yes, hi. My question has to do with political leadership. It seems that politics has always been divisive, but at least in the past, there have been leaders that have worked to get along, and it's very frustrating nowadays to see that politics seems to have disintegrated into let's see, you know, how bad we can make the other side or the other person look, and so forth. And just appreciate your comments on on what we need to get things turned around. Thank you very much.
I can't answer the last part, but I think that the caller is absolutely correct. But first of all, let's back up. I think politics is always adversarial. And I think, by the way, within a democracy, that's the point, that you have different points of view, that that adversary doesn't mean hatred, enemy. It means debate and discussion. If you look back in history, Washington and John Adams had horrible times with Congress. So did, you know, Jefferson. So did Thomas Jefferson. And certainly in the Civil War, there were so many different cliques in Congress. Lincoln was hamstrung left, right, and sideways. But I think what's happened in the modern age, there used to be a time when senators all lived in Washington. There used to be a time when congressmen knew each other and recreated with each other, in which they were the loyal opposition because they had to live there. Now they're always gone. I think what's happened now is kind of niche politics, that it's totally adversarial in this sense. If you've got power, instead of the loyal opposition to help correct and manage, our job is to take over that power. And I think that that was really came to bear with the Clinton administration. They wanted Clinton out. Now, I'm not saying that Mr. Clinton wasn't guilty of a couple of unfortunate incidents. But the point is, it became as if you're not there. When Jimmy Carter won this thing, it was like, why are you there? We want that from you. So I think adversary has now become opponent for power rather than adversary for the people.
Let's talk about one of the political leaders you use as an example in your book, Winston Churchill, in your chapter on moral judgment and moral vision.
And we chose, Churchill can be used, you know, Winston Churchill, fill in the blank. You know, what do you want to say about him? He's one of those characters, right? But we wanted to use him for moral vision because of Churchill's tenacity. Churchill, you know, Churchill, by the time Hitler was coming around in 1933, was a backbencher. You know, he had been guilty of Gallipoli and the war. He had served marvelously in the war. He had been in the cabinet, so on and so forth. But now he's a backbencher, an old guy, drank a lot of alcohol, and wrote a lot of books that nobody read. But he was still in Parliament and still paying attention. And he kept saying, this Nazi guy is not just another leader. He's not just the new guy on the block in Germany that's going to help Germany get out of its depression. And you got to remember, 1939, both FDR and Adolf Hitler were 6 years in office and had taken their countries out of the depression. And in 1939, Hitler was Man of the Year for Time magazine. He kept saying, this is evil. This man is evil. This man, I've read Mein Kampf. I've had it translated. I read one of the first translations. I've read the news reports. I've talked to journalists. This is evil. This is a clash of civilizations. Unless we prepare ourselves for this, we'll be doomed and damned. He was right. And he kept saying that. And it's only by his tenacity that, in some sense, Chamberlain was put out of office and a real defense of England began. And happily, Dunkirk didn't happen on the negative side, and Churchill immediately went to America and said to FDR, this is going to happen to us unless you're involved in this as well. And those two men plotted the salvation of the world.
A couple more examples I wanted to get into. Aesthetic sensitivity as a virtue of a leader. That's a different one.
Yeah, that is totally different. And my colleague Ron Green, who is this wonderful, it was such a pleasure writing with a dear friend, and we're still friends, how about that, and planning other books. We wanted to talk about a sense of sensitivity. You know, everyone talks about intellectual excellence, and certainly, you know, when we talk about politics, you're talking about Jefferson and FDR and even JFK, this hunger, this openness to, you know, new knowledge. But also aesthetic sensitivities. And I think Steve Jobs didn't create the computer. He created a beautiful computer. He created a beautiful way of learning. He changed how we learn, what we learn, what's available to us, even if you know people have planned on that. And I think, as Daniel Pink talks about, we don't just make products. We have to make beautiful products. As someone once said, oh, the gentleman at General Motors said, we're not in the car business. We're in the business of design, and we just happen to have what we design as things that take us around. I think that beauty is part of our lives, and I think it's a feature of our lives, and I think that that has to be brought into us as well. You know, we have a mayor that is now gone, Mayor Daley in Chicago. Oh, I'm sure he's going to be castigated here, there, and everywhere for a while. You know how that goes. But he made Chicago beautiful, and he'll always be remembered for that. And I think that's a part of leadership.
One more I wanted to get to, the idea of compassion and care as a virtue as exemplified by Oprah Winfrey.
Yeah, another strange one, because here's what we're committed to, and then we'll bring in Oprah to not as a defense, but as an example. I think leaders have to be emotionally connected to their leadership, that is, to those they lead. I think there has to be a human connection. Woodrow Wilson, again, in the book, what I'm finding wonderful about reading this Woodrow Wilson book is he is not this automaton we now see in the old films and, you know, the pictures where he's kind of stiff as a board, this Presbyterian guy from Princeton, you know, professor from Princeton. He ends up being a completely passionate human being who loved his wives, chased his second wife around the White House, if you will, figuratively and literally, a real human being. But one of his problems was, and when he went out on the stump, people knew that. But he had to get out there all the time. You need a leader, and certainly the modern press, the modern media, you know, the most photographed man in the world every single day is, you know, the President of the United States, both by law and by tradition now. You need someone who resonates with others. And in a very real sense, Oprah Winfrey's success is based on her being able to resonate with an audience and creating not simply an audience, but a followership. When her show was on, 44 million people a week watched it. My mother would rather have shot her foot off than miss it, right? And what she created was a pool of people who were not dependent upon her, but looked to her for something. That's still leadership. She changed culture. She changed what we read and how we read. She changed many people's lives in different ways. And I think that was kind of a stretch, but in a very real sense, her success is built on the fact that people really believed that she liked them.
Al, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
This has been a pleasure for me.
That was Al Jeaney. He's a professor at Loyola University Chicago. He's co-author of the new book, 10 Virtues of Outstanding Leaders.
Coming up, we'll stare into the amorphous goo of a lava lamp on its 50th anniversary. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.